all three.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is March 28th. My lands, we're almost to April. We're going to do Senate Bill 810 first. There's only one person signed up, and there are 40 people for the other three bills. So just to let you know that because we have so many people, we're going to try, except for the very first bill, have everyone limit their comments to about 3 minutes apiece. All right, with that, I would again open a public hearing on Senate Bill 810. And Oliver, bring us up to date on what 810 does. And Ann Ness, come forward.
And then she wants to testify, so she will write it down.
Okay. And who else wants to testify? Chelsea, yes. Rosard, and anyone else want to testify on 810? Okay.
Madam Chair, I will, but they can go first.
Oh, okay, great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 810, brought to you by Senator Canope, requires the state treasurer to establish the Oregon Health Savings Account program, allows Oregon taxpayers to pay for qualified medical expenses using pre-tax dollars deposited in their health savings accounts. The bill requires the State Department of Revenue to adopt a formula to determine withhold amounts for individual health savings accounts. The bill takes effect on the 91st day following signing die. There are no amendments and no impact statements. Submitted testimony is available on OLIS.
And Chelsea, are you in favor or against the bill?
Neutral, I guess.
Okay, so then I'd rather have Tim go first.
Do you want me to go first?
Okay, yeah.
You could probably just stay down there all day if you wanted to.
Sure, there are others who wish to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Tim Canope from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And I have brought you Senate Bill 810 today, which establishes Oregon Health Savings Account programs in the Office of the Treasurer and enables Oregon taxpayers to reduce their taxable income by making contributions to the program that reimburses taxpayers qualified medical expenses. As you undoubtedly know, there are some federal health savings accounts, but they're pretty difficult to access. They're not widely available due to the federal oversight and regulation. And only certain types of insurance qualify for them. So really what this bill does is it creates this HSAs, and the savings would be exempt from Oregon income tax. And it would help people essentially take health savings into their own hands, which is one of my goals for healthcare generally. There is no health insurance requirement to participate. And qualified medical expenses would be defined by IRS code, but it's pretty broad in that it covers virtually all health-related costs, from prescriptions to breast pumps to office visits to kind of you name it. If it's a healthcare procedure, it would be covered and available for you to use money from your Oregon health savings account. And so I think it's a program that's worthy of discussion, especially in these times, as it, you know, we are looking at potential transition, and obviously there's a lot going on at the federal level, but I really think that it's important that we have health savings accounts and really put people's health care, their decisions about how they spend their money, and give them the opportunity to save more money for the health care that our citizens want versus the health care that government may want for them. So that's really the goal of my bill, and I can't imagine anybody opposing the bill. So if we want to go to work session now, Madam Chair? Maybe not. So I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
Let's hear the panel. Do you mind staying there?
I don't. I'd be happy to. So
Chelsea, you go next, and then Ann.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Broussard. I'm the policy director for the Oregon State Treasury. Senate Bill 810 recently came to our attention, and while we agree with the sponsor that the accounts should be located in Treasury, our issue with the bill is a little bit more technical. We believe that the administration of the program should be in a healthcare-related agency with expertise in this issue. So if this bill moves forward, we're happy to work with the sponsors and stakeholders on making these changes.
Thank you. Ann. My name is Ann Nessie. I'm in Lori Monsander's district. I think she knows me. But today I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon. And first of all, savings is always a good idea. But medical savings presents a much more complicated situation. Today, persons' medical costs can be so high in our present marketplace, and you have no bargaining power as an individual. So you may save a ton of money, but it won't make any difference. So we're allowing tax credits for something that may not be in your best interest. Your costs can easily exceed your savings. However, Senate Bill 110, by allowing individuals a tax shelter, in other words, taxpayer money is not, you know, we're not collecting taxes on that money, in health savings accounts only benefits those with considerably higher incomes. If you have a middle or lower income, you probably don't have extra funds and the ability to do that kind of savings. Then what we instead need is a good health insurance option for these people, for most of us, where they're part of a larger pool. You know, you put in a little bit, and you're going to get better service. In conclusion, we recommend that Senate Bill 810 should not be passed out of committee. I can tell you that right now, we looked it up, it has $22.3 million of untaxed money in our general fund. So if we don't have that savings account, which isn't necessarily in the good interests of individuals anyway, we would have a more equitableness in our tax system and provide revenue to meet the state's health care gap. I'm a nurse, as Lori is, and my husband is a general practice physician, and we're quite aware of the problems of paying for health care. This bill would definitely reduce the general fund in times when we have a lot of debt right now.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for the... Yes, Senator Cruz.
Comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have been toying with this concept for many years in this building, trying to find a way for people to get a health savings account. The focus has always been for long-term care up to this point, but to do something that is accessible at any point in time, I think probably even makes more sense and may get more people interested. The problem with the long-term care concept was it's tough to get young people to focus on what they need 40 years in the future. But this that would have an instant benefit to people, I think, would be a very good idea. I'm hoping that we will bring this back and refer it on to finance and revenue, where it could have a full discussion of all the ramifications. And the only other thing, Madam Chair, I would point out that the term tax fairness has different meanings to different people in this building.
Okay. Really? Any other comments? Thank you very much.
So, Madam Chair, might
yes.
I just add
yes, please.
That so ultimately my goal is really to create that opportunity where the taxpayers can be in charge of their own health care. And so if we achieve that, we are able to essentially tax less, and it's less of a burden on government entities in terms of funding. And so really my goal is to, like a 401k, have every citizen have a health savings account that employers could put money into. You could put, money or subsidy from, federal or state, as well as potentially pay for health insurance. So ultimately, that's my goal. But I wanted to get this bill before the legislature this session, and hopefully try to work toward that end, because ultimately I think this is a freedom issue about, you know, individuals. And so I think our society is really designed to vest freedom in the individual. So whether that's health freedom, whether that's retirement security, and those types of things. And the government continues to encroach upon those, and it only gets more costly. And so that's part of the reason I bring the bill forward, and I just want to make sure that that was clear.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Anybody understand what I was saying, that sometimes the savings doesn't pan out for the individual?
Yes.
Okay. As long as
All right. You Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And there's no one else signed up for Senate Bill 810, so I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 810. And the next three bills are vaccination bills, and it seems like we have the same people on the same bills. And so I'm going to open a public hearing on all three bills. So when I call you up, just introduce yourself and then start with one bill, state what yours you want on that, then go to the other one, and that, and I think hopefully we'll be able to be more efficient that way. I'm hoping, because I would like everyone to be able to testify. All right, with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 869, Senate Bill 880, and Senate Bill 914. And do you want to introduce one, Tim, or not?
Hello, this is Brittany.
Brittany, this is Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and I hear that you want to testify on one of the bills.
Yes, I do.
Well, we'll start with you first then, and you can then, after your testimony, either hang up or listen to the entire, we have, I think, 40 testimonies that we need to hear today. And I'm limiting everyone to about 3 minutes a piece on each bill. All right, so which bill would you like to testify on?
Well, I would like to testify on all of them, but to make it simple, I have a personal story on Senate Bill 869, which you have there probably already. You probably already read it. It's there on your screen.
We haven't introduced them yet. Just
so
a minute.
So really briefly, I have 3 minutes.
Okay, just wait while... Yeah, I want to first ask Senator Canope if he wants to say anything.
No, let's go ahead with public testimony.
Okay, public testimony. All right, do you want to describe each bill?
I'm quickly will describe it. Senate Bill 869 is brought to you by Senator Boquist. The measure requires healthcare professionals to obtain informed consent from the parent of a child unless the child is emancipated for administering a vaccination. Senate Bill 580 is brought to you by Senator Canope. The measure requires healthcare professionals to provide immunization regarding a vaccination prior to administering the vaccination to the child. And Senate Bill 914 is also brought to you by Senator Canope. The bill prohibits employers from requiring mandatory immunizations as a condition of employment.
All right. So, Brittany, would you please start the testimony on 869?
Yes, thank you so much. And thank you, Senator Moniz Anderson, for scheduling this bill. I really appreciate that. And thank you, members of the committee, for hearing my testimony. So I'm just going to read my testimony so you have it. On February
17th... And state your name for the record.
Oh, sorry about that. This is Brittany Ruiz, and I also happen to be the author of Senate Bill 869. On February 7th, 2011, I was induced due to a rare medical condition called cholestasis of pregnancy. My daughter at the date of induction was just under 36 weeks gestation. Through amniocentesis, the specialist and my OB both agreed her lungs were totally healthy for induction. My daughter was born happy and healthy February 8th, 2011. Previous to that, I was not made aware that there were any vaccinations or medical interventions required following birth. Even at our birthing class we did at the hospital, the nurse said they were going to administer vitamin K injection. I balked and asked about it, texted some of my experienced mom friends, and they all say it's just a vitamin and nothing else. So I agreed to administer. What followed after my daughter got administered the vitamin K1 injection was she started having respiratory arrest. Her oxygen levels were dropping and she was rushed to the NICU for observation. She was kept in breathing bubble, and later the doctor, the NICU, ordered a CPAP for 4 days and oxygen another 2 days. You can see photo of this in the NICU. She finally got to nurse on the sixth day in the NICU. When I asked the doctors and NICU nurses and specialists what was going on, they all said, we don't have any answers. Her Her test results came back negative for any inflammation or any dysfunction. Her lungs are clear. We will just have to give her IV antibiotics for the first 5 days just to be safe. Following that, Riley, my daughter, had extreme hyperbilirubinemia, which is basically jaundice, and had to be on Billy lights nonstop for hours, so much so that they wouldn't let me do kangaroo care. For a premature baby, that's considered extremely valuable. My OB blamed himself for an early induction and said my daughter was the first baby he had any issues with, and he really thought he did every precaution to make sure the baby was going to be fine. It took me 4 years to heal my daughter from not only that injection, but also 5 days of antibiotics at birth. Whatever good bacteria she got being born naturally was wiped out completely. It destroyed her gut, her teeth, and she had nonstop health issues with candida infections, colic, yeast infections, seasonal allergies, and she lost 2 molars as soon as they came in. After some years of no answers, I had a friend forward me the vaccine package insert for vitamin K injection. Right on the package insert were the explanations to my daughter's reactions following birth and the administration of the vitamin K shot. Right in there. My pediatrician had no clue that these were side effects. My OB, my family physician, the NICU doctor or nurses, none of them knew. They are not required to review the package insert. They are only told this is something we do after every single birth. If my doctor followed protocol to make sure I had full and informed consent, if I had read that vaccine package insert and all the ingredients that were in the vitamin K1 injection, I would have been able to save my daughter from 4 years of health issues and a week stay in the NICU and a huge hospital bill. I've been able to say that oral is safer because my daughter is premature. I was never given that option or education. As you know, the vitamin K shot has a black box warning label, and you'll notice on intramuscular administration, typically these severe reactions have resembled hypersensitivity or anaphylaxis, including shock and cardiac and or respiratory arrest. Some patients have exhibited these severe reactions on receiving vitamin K for the first time. It also says further down on the insert, hemolysis, jaundice, and hyperbilirubinemia in newborns, particularly in premature infants, may be related to the dose of vitamin K1 injection intramuscularly. Therefore, so from this experience and following up, hearing other parents' stories and on this, I personally think that more education, not less, is important in this situation. Having available all of the side effects, all of the ingredients is important, and I urge you to pass this bill, and that's, there you go.
Great. And Brittany, thank you so much. And do you have just brief comments on Senate Bill 580 and Senate Bill 914?
Yes, and thank you for asking. I do. On 580, I just think it's important because we've recently, even at my school, they said, hey, you need to get your kids caught up on these vaccines with no mention of exemption or even mention of any of the other, the fact that they're even available. So I think it's important on 580 that they know that there are exemptions available to them in case they want their kids to not have to take those vaccines. And a lot of the parents have done extensive research or have already had vaccinated children and want to have the option of that exemption, and they're not made aware of that. And then on Senate Bill 914, I specifically actually was kind of humorous. I actually went to a senator meeting regarding this bill, urging them to vote in favor of this. And after I walked out, I met with a college student, and we were talking to her about why we were there. And she said that she was told that if she did not get the flu vaccine shot, she would not be able to do her clinical training in a clinic. So she went and got it, but she was super scared that she was going to get all of the side effects listed on it, seeing that, you know, last year, the CDC said that the flu vaccine was only 48% effective, and it's also the highest vaccine with the highest injury attached to the flu vaccine. So you have a higher risk with a very low result. So I think it's very important that we don't require mandatory vaccines for employees, and some of them, especially nurses and doctors, have religious beliefs attached to it. So I really think that we should never mandate a vaccine, a medical procedure for employment. And there you go. I'm done.
All right. Thank you so very much. Questions for Brittany? All right. With that, thank you, Brittany. I would like to call up Robert Snead, Janet Patton, Dr. Janet Patton, and Darcy Raposa. And introduce yourself, speak to each bill that you want to speak to, and we'll open it up for questions after the panel's heard.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson. My name is Robert Snee, and I'm an attorney in Portland and co-chair of Oregonians for Medical Freedom. We're a bipartisan group of over 2,000 members that truly believe that truly informed consent is essential in preserving our liberties as well as protecting our well-being. James Lyons Weiler is an independent research scientist, and his latest book is entitled The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. He summarized it very well for me this morning. He said, intolerance of knowledge is a tool of a totalitarian state. We live in an age of information. It's important that everyone have access to all relevant information. 4 years ago, this legislature passed a law that created an education module for those wishing to claim a non-medical exemption to vaccines. Those who supported the bill stated that for those wanting to claim an exemption, quote, we're going to require parents to have a conversation with their primary care provider to go over all the benefits of immunization and address any risks or concerns. This will allow for true informed consent. The problem with the current state of the law, and because of deliberate government policies at the federal and state level, is this. Those who opt to receive vaccinations give their consent without being truly informed. Further, I've watched the educational modules that provide an alternative to a conversation with your healthcare provider. The videos present a one-sided view that falls short of providing true informed consent. They're heavy on the risks of disease and benefits of vaccines, short on the known potential risks of vaccines. The information must be CDC approved, and the CDC is conflicted because they both purchase and market vaccines as well as are responsible for ensuring the safety of them. The foundation of medical ethics is the Hippocratic Oath, quote, to prescribe regimens for the good of my patients and never to do harm to anyone. A look back through history shows that every time there's been an attempt to change medical ethics from a humanitarian to a utilitarian view for the, quote, greater good of society, it's resulted in practices that shock the conscience and should never be accepted. It was a result of some of these intolerable practices that in the last century led to the development of the Nuremberg Code, which primarily applies to scientific testing. The first principle of the Nuremberg Code is, quote, the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. This means the person involved should be so situated to exercise free power of choice without the intervention of any element of force, fraud, deceit, duress, or other ulterior form of coercion, and should have sufficient knowledge and comprehension of the elements to make an understanding and enlightened decision. The FDA, the CDC, and vaccine makers openly state that often the number of human subjects used in pre-licensing studies are too small to detect rarer adverse events, making post-marketing surveillance a de facto scientific experiment. When you consider this fact, it underscores the need for people to be given full, unbiased information so they are truly informed. Even going further than the Nuremberg Code is the Universal Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights, adopted by all 193 countries participating in the United Nations, including the United States. Article 6 of the Declaration states that individuals must give, quote, prior, free, and informed consent to, quote, any preventative, diagnostic, and therapeutic medical intervention. The sole interest of society, of science or society, here, think about the flawed herd immunity theory argument, is not more important than the rights of the individual. Any and every argument that vaccination rates may go down if people have more information, and the opponents of this legislation will make this argument, is an argument to protect the herd, which diminishes the rights of the individual. The idea that people must vaccinate to protect the herd is not only repugnant to the principles of liberty and freedom that are the foundations of this country, but it's repugnant to the Universal Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights adopted by this country. Parents are not fully informed of all risks associated with vaccines, and it's an essential requirement that they receive more information to get and give truly fully informed consent. The vast majority of people are unaware of the existence of a national compensation program as the only route for compensation if their child is injured from a vaccine. A 2014 audit conducted by the General Accounting Office of the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program demonstrated that the government had utterly failed to undertake reasonable efforts to inform the public about the NVICP.
You're at 4 minutes.
This bill would require that knowledge of the program be provided for those who are potentially most in need of that information. As of March 1st, $3.6 billion has been paid to persons injured by vaccines, and average compensation is $300,000 per person. But of course, the only thing we hear from the government and health agencies and medical professionals is that vaccines are, quote, safe and effective. The sheer number and amount of those claims paid for the vaccine injury testify to the fact vaccines are not safe, as the public is told. Parents are also not made aware of all legal rights, including the right to claim non-medical exemptions. The idea that too much information will scare patients and will claim an exemption and not vaccinating again is an argument in favor of the herd. It infringes upon the rights of each individual. Deliberate government policies restricting information on vaccines begin at the federal level, at the CDC and the FDA. In publishing a rule concerning the live polio vaccine, the FDA stated on June 1 of 1984 that, quote, any possible doubts, whether or not well-founded, about the safety of the vaccine cannot be allowed to exist in view of the need to assure that the vaccine will continue to be used to the maximum extent. This statement has become a de facto government policy regarding all vaccines. It's a call for censorship of serious and relevant scientific data, which puts individuals at risk and is demonstrated in everything we hear from government health agencies and the corporate mainstream media. In fact, the media has helped create a culture of ridiculing those who are vaccine risk aware and seek greater vaccine safety, as well as disrespecting, disparaging, and dismissing those who have children that suffered vaccine injury. According to the OHA website, the Toxic Free Kids Act was passed in the 2015 legislative session. This law requires manufacturers of children's products sold in Oregon to report products that contain one or more high-priority chemicals of concern for children's health and ultimately remove these chemicals within the next 10 years. Harm or injury from toxic chemicals can permanently alter a child's lifelong development and health. Now, the presence of these chemicals in a product does not necessarily mean the product will harm a child's health or that there's any violation of existing safety standards of law. In order for a child's health to be harmed by a toxic chemical, that chemical must somehow get out of the product and into the body. Vaccines are not included in this law. However, under the law, the OHA has published a list of high-priority chemicals of concern that ultimately must be removed from children's consumer products. Essentially, a zero-tolerance policy is in the process of being instituted. There's 61 different vaccines listed by the CDC in their published vaccine ingredient summary. Some vaccines have more than one manufacturer. And this bill would require that vaccine ingredients be provided to patients and parents of children who are going to be vaccinated. Of the 61 vaccines listed, 31 contain at least one and as many as three of the chemicals that are on that list of high-priority chemicals of concern. The potential chronic health effects from those three chemicals, also shown on the list published by OHA, include liver effects, developmental effects, central nervous system effects, leukemia, nose and throat cancers, and asthma-like respiratory systems. I have to wonder, why weren't vaccines included in the list of products covered under the Toxic Free Kids Act?
Okay, you're going to have to sum up and be sure that you get your testimony
I've submitted it via email to the committee already.
Thank you.
You do have it already, Chair. Thank you. Now, parents do have a right to know the vaccine ingredients. Now, as to 580, I was always taught that a half-truth is a lie. Currently, our OHA lies to people because they talk about Oregon law requiring vaccines. They rarely, if ever, let people know about the availability of medical and non-medical exemptions. There's a flyer that is often found in doctors' offices and schools that contains an asterisk, Oregon law requires the following shots for school and school care attendants. But there's nothing in that asterisk that contains information about the availability of exemptions. This bill would require that such notices are also included in the statutory reference, and the law that requires those vaccines also includes the right to exemptions. Now, people should get more than half-truths from their government. Finally, this bill is virtually, 869 is virtually identical to a similar bill that was considered last year in Oklahoma. That bill passed with overwhelming and almost unanimous bipartisan support in both the Oklahoma and Senate and House of Representatives. Regrettably, fearful that the bill would violate that de facto policy of not allowing well-founded safety doubts to exist, the bill was vetoed by the governor. Please don't let Oregon continue to follow in the footsteps of government-endorsed censorship of relevant information solely because that information may create well-founded doubts. Let Oregon be a beacon of light leading the way that stands up to the foundations of liberty and individual rights stated in our Declaration of Independence, recognized in our Constitution, and universally recognized in the Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Could I have one moment with respect to 914?
We're at 9 minutes, and at the end, if we have, I want to make sure I have enough time for everybody. So at the end, if we still have time, then I'll call you back.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes.
Oh, great. All right. Set my timer.
She was against his wife. My name is Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Janet Patton. I have been a board-certified family physician in Oregon for 20 years, the first 18 of them in rural Oregon on the coast in Reedsport, and more recently with Providence Medical Group in Gresham. I am a member of the Oregon Health Authority's Immunization Practice Advisory Team, and I represent the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians there. So this is an important conversation about vaccines and education and personal choice versus public health. So in Senate Bills 869 and 580, I wish to stand in opposition. What is the intent of these bills, the informed consent with a written notice of vaccines required for school, and the availability of non-medical exemptions before each vaccine? The intent appears to be giving patients all the information they need before a vaccine is given. Do these bills achieve that intent? I believe the answer is no. Each creates an administrative burden that will effectively reduce vaccination and increase illness. They are redundant, as the vaccine information statement already succinctly summarizes risk, benefit, and the vaccine injury compensation program. In the rare event of problems. They give a skewed impression that school-required vaccines are a higher priority than the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice schedule of recommended vaccines. And they encourage exemption as a reasonable out with no regard to the public health risks that exemption brings. Vaccines are safe and effective. There are many misconceptions about vaccines. Unfortunately, research has shown that the power of vivid cases, an emotional and dramatic testimonial, are remembered better and given more weight. So Aunt Mabel's dramatic story outweighs a stack of science. As Neil deGrasse Tyson states, the wonderful thing about science is that it's true even if you don't believe in it. One study found that when education successfully reduced misperceptions of vaccines, it nevertheless did not impact the intent to vaccinate, and when paired with images of sick children, could increase erroneous beliefs of vaccine side effects. So giving more information does not necessarily lead to protecting more people through effective vaccination. Herd immunity does require a high rate of vaccination to protect the few who aren't vaccinated, which is about 80% of healthy people and 90% of high-risk people. Another study found having a philosophical exemption and easy exemption process are both correlated with 2 to 2.5 times higher the exemption rates of states without philosophical exemptions or more difficult processes. So with more exemptions, we lose the added benefit of herd immunity. Lack of vaccination leads to death and disability, which is why we develop them in the first place. Over 300,000 adults die every year from influenza, and there have been 55 pediatric deaths nationwide to date in this current influenza season. These are preventable deaths, and even a 30% effectiveness rate of the vaccine is enough to keep you out of the intensive care unit. So perhaps you also recall the mumps outbreak amongst high school wrestlers in Salem this past fall. Mumps can cause hearing loss and sterility and is preventable. Why encourage that risk? The benefits to the individual and the community of recommended vaccines far outweigh the risks. Our intention as healthcare providers is to give every Oregonian a safe and healthy environment to achieve their maximal potential. Vaccines promote this end. We already follow the principles of informed consent, and it is not good public health policy to encourage exemptions. While they may be well-intentioned, these bills are unnecessary and harmful. On Senate Bill 914, this goes to the heart of the tension between personal choice and public health, and weighs in favor of the individual at the cost of the community. I believe that this is the wrong direction, stating that immunizations are personal health care decisions. easy examples of comparable public good for which we sacrifice a bit of individual liberty include obeying traffic laws, seat belts, and helmet use. There is case law that under certain circumstances, the government may restrict personal liberty to protect the public's health. Since 1905, there's a U.S. Supreme Court decision about smallpox vaccination in Jacobson versus Massachusetts, where courts have ruled that states have the authority to exercise their 10th Amendment police powers to require immunizations, and that public health considerations related to the threats posed by transmissible disease trump individual autonomy to refuse health care. There is good and extensive science behind vaccine recommendations. They work and are well studied. While nothing is perfect, there's a preponderance of 23,600 articles that point to widespread moderate benefit from influenza vaccine. Scientific evidence is not a personal decision. Vaccines in certain places of employment become a life and death issue. While influenza has a 0.1% mortality for you and me out here, hospitalized patients who acquire influenza have a 20 to 27% mortality. So a quarter of them are going to die from being exposed to influenza, and their unvaccinated treatment team members are the principal way that they're exposed. 16 states legally require influenza vaccination for healthcare workers. I believe Oregon should join them for the sake of our patients. We should not be bringing them things that kill them. This bill takes us in the wrong direction to protect our fellow Oregonians when they are most vulnerable, and I stand in opposition to Senate Bill 914. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's go ahead with the next person. Thank you very much.
Chair Mona Sanderson and the committee, I'm here today in support of SB 869, informed consent.
You need to say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Darcy Raposa. Informed consent, being given all of the information, including risks and benefits of a medical procedure, has always been the foundation of the American medical system. However, in the area of vaccinations, parents are rarely given true informed consent. When it comes to vaccinations, information is heavily skewed toward the touted benefits of the procedure with little or any emphasis placed on possible risks. Vaccinations are a medical procedure that, unlike any other medical procedure, are routinely given in a one-size-fits-all fashion to all children. As with most medical procedures, they carry with them the risk of injury, as evidenced by the over $3 billion that has been paid out of the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, or the VICP. Parents deserve to have all of the information regarding a vaccination that's about to be administered to their child, and this includes having access to the package insert, which lists all possible risks and side effects and contains information on how the vaccine was tested if they choose to read it, and information on how to file a claim pursuant to the VICP. Many parents are unaware that there is even a process to report adverse vaccine reactions or injuries until after the statute of limitations for filing a claim is passed. This is not right, and it needs to be corrected. In regards to SB 580, I'm also here in support of that. The vaccination exemptions have been made available in Oregon's law for parents that have religious or philosophical objections to some or all vaccinations. Yet I believe that we've done a poor job of communicating this information to parents. Although there is information on OHA's website regarding the non-medical vaccine exemption, if you look at the immunization requirements flyer, it's right here, that's given out in, and I know I've gotten this myself in school packets and posted in doctor's offices. There is no mention of any exemptions, even the medical exemptions, on this flyer. So if a parent is uneducated about what the law actually says, they wouldn't know from this poster what their rights actually are. As vaccinations are a medical procedure that carries the risk of injury or death, parents need to know all of their rights under Oregon law. And then finally, SB 914, I'm in support of that as well. So every year I've read more and more news reports from around the country of people in the healthcare field that have been fired from their job for refusal to get a shot, specifically the flu shot. In some cases, even employees that have no patient contact have been required to receive a flu shot or risk being fired. This is even more disturbing to me when coupled with information that comes out most year that speaks about how ineffective the current year shot was once again. And I don't believe that anyone's livelihood should be in jeopardy by refusing to undergo a medical procedure that may injure or kill them. This is an issue that's not going away, and I think that Oregon should codify its citizens' rights in law to protect them from having to choose between their job and their health. Thank you.
Wow, you got just over 3 minutes on all three bills. You're awesome. All right, thank you very much, panel. And I would like to call up Lynn Pearson, Jordan, is it Ord? And Linda Lee McCandles. And please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Jordan Orr, and I don't have a testimony. I just wanted to say that I'm in support of all three bills.
Well, that was quick, short, and sweet. Thank you very much.
Sorry, she was sleeping. Hello, my name is Leah Pearson, and I am in favor of all three bills proposed. I just find it a little bit ludicrous that anybody would be against more information for somebody making a decision. They should have all the information presented to them. As parents, we're trying to do what's best for our children. Nobody's going to flippantly decide to do something that might harm them with this information. They're just trying to make the best choice, and they should have all the information given to them. So I'm in favor of all three.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for my testimony. My name is Linda Lee McCandless, and on behalf of my four-year-old twins and myself, I am in support of all three bills. As a parent, I have spent literally hundreds of hours in research, and that option is not always available to everyone. I'm a stay-at-home mom. I had 6 weeks of bed rest before my twins were born, and I used those 6 weeks to research vaccines, and that's how I came to my conclusions. Not only did I read the printed material that was available, I cross-referenced everything on the pharmaceutical websites to see if what I was reading was true, and that's how I came to my decision. But a lot of my friends just walk in lockstep with what they've been told by their physicians. And I think it's very important that as a parent, if you're going to suffer the repercussions of the effects on your child for the rest of your life and that child's life potentially, that you should have all of the information available to you. Recently, a friend of mine who was very pro-vaccine decided on her own, not with any consultation with myself or anyone on my side of the game, and she went into the doctor's office and asked for the package insert for the vaccine, and the doctor literally ran out of the room, and they could not provide her. The clinic went kind of on fire looking for package inserts. They could not provide her with package insert to give her an informed choice. So I think these bills are very important, because as a parent, I agree with the previous testimony. We want the very best for our children, and we want all of the information that's available to make those choices.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Chandless, Lori Oliver, and Preston Oliver.
I am Dewey McCandless. That was my wife who just spoke. I just think it's important that we all have the right to decide what happens to our own children. Our two little boys are precious to us. They're not precious probably to too many other people, but for us, they are everything. So I support everything that my wife just said.
Thank you very much.
My name is Lori Oliver. I'm a mother and grandmother. In my personal experience, which because of that, I am here in support of all three the items of discussion today. And it all started when my daughter at 2 months had a reaction to the DPT and polio shots she was given. Fortunately, it wasn't as severe as the terrible tragedies that do happen, but it started me on my journey of doing just what the woman before me was speaking of, researching. And back then there was no internet. It was magazine articles, and wherever I could get any information, I would read about it. At 5 months, my daughter was given a booster, a polio booster. The pediatrician assuring me that it was safe, and me never once ever seen a reaction. Well, she had such a reaction immediately. Within 2 minutes, she was covered in hives and screaming, and he had his staff call 911. He then had staff negate that call, and but it scared him. Anyway, it wasn't life-threatening, but it was, you know, it goes to show that not every person is going to have a beneficial effect. And thankfully, my daughter wasn't hurt. But over the years, I was treated like I was accused of child abuse by a nurse in a hospital, but for not vaccinating my children. I never was informed that there were exemptions. I found out otherwise, but the schools made it sound like your kid would be kicked out if they didn't get their vaccines. And the pressure on parents to vaccinate without question is so high. I believe these measures that we're talking about today need to be in place, especially in this climate and with states all over the country introducing bills for mandatory vaccination, which we had one up last year or 2 years ago that was that didn't end up being put in action in Oregon, thankfully. But I believe that this is a good proactive way to prevent parents from being pressured into decisions that ultimately could harm their children. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Preston Oliver. I'm in favor of the three bills before the committee. My wife has testified. My daughter testified earlier. In addition to all the other pro-bill testimony, I would just encourage anybody who wants to research this, when it comes to Big Pharma, is to follow the money. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. Ryan Day, Aaron Dunn. Let's start. That was two.
Good afternoon, Chair Manez Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Day, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Government Affairs for the March of Dimes. The March of Dimes was founded to fight polio and fund research that ultimately produced vaccines which eliminated the disease in the U.S. and almost every other nation on Earth. Over the past decades, the United States has virtually eliminated many diseases, largely due to the development of effective administration of vaccines. Public awareness about the dangers of these diseases and the benefits of vaccines was key to their elimination. Tragically, memories of serious illnesses have faded, and a widely cited but universally discredited study planted the seeds of doubt and fear among many. Taken together, we find that immunization rates have dropped, and in some communities, herd immunity no longer protects the most vulnerable, the young, the old, and those whose immune systems are compromised. I urge you to vote against Senate Bill 580. The policy pushed forward in this bill is designed to guide parents towards minimizing the number of vaccinations that their child receives. It forces medical providers to explain exemptions to mandatory vaccinations for public schools, portraying vaccines as optional and ineffective, provide further lowering vaccination rates. I also urge you to vote against Senate Bill 869. Informed consent is already the standard of practice for medical professionals when administering vaccines or any medical procedure. So in practical terms, this bill would accomplish nothing. However, this language will be used as a red herring by skeptics, and they will point to this language and say, why would medical professionals be required by law to gain informed consent if vaccines are safe? I also strongly urge you to oppose Senate Bill 914. This bill would bar employers from requiring vaccinations as a condition of employment. Nothing would prevent an individual who is unvaccinated from working on a NICU or working in a pediatric oncology ward. We'd risk the lives of some of our most vulnerable citizens for this exemption. Staff at nursing care facilities could expose their patients to a variety of diseases, and the entire rationale for mandatory school vaccines is undermined if staff are not held to the same standard. These diseases can kill and maim otherwise healthy people, but SB 914 would chip away at our ability to protect our most vulnerable citizens, babies, the sick, and the elderly. As you will hear many times today, for vaccines to be effective, herd immunity is crucial and that we have to have extremely high rates of vaccination among the population. The more we chip away at policies that promote vaccination, the more outbreaks we will see of vaccine-preventable diseases. What will that look like? The March of Dimes has antique iron lungs in our national office if you want to see what that looks like. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monsanderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide information about childhood immunizations. My name is Aaron Dunn. I'm the immunization manager for Oregon within the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. Senate Bill 580 proposes requiring healthcare practitioners before administering vaccines to provide written notice of which vaccines are required to attend school or child care. Immunizations are one of the most effective public health interventions in history. Vaccines have eliminated smallpox from the world, restricted polio to a few spots in Nigeria, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, eliminated measles and rubella transmission in all of the Americas, and reduced the risk of most other vaccine-preventable diseases to a fraction of what they were in the pre-vaccine era. Much of this has been achieved by herd immunity, that is, immunizing enough people that the disease no longer has enough susceptible people to sustain its transmission, so that even non-immune people, especially the most vulnerable, are protected. The Oregon Health Authority, therefore, supports the widespread use of vaccines. Medical providers are in the best position to advise their patients on which vaccines they should receive based on their unique situation and medical status. We are concerned that routinely providing a list of vaccines required for school and childcare attendance may encourage some parents to prioritize required vaccines over those recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, and their medical provider. In the United States, medical practitioners follow the recommended immunization schedule approved annually by ACIP and published by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Key factors are considered in the development of these recommendations. They include the balance of benefits and harms, the type or quality of evidence, values and preferences of the people affected, and health economic analysis. The recommended immunization schedule represents the consensus of leading vaccine experts on the best way to protect children from vaccine-preventable diseases. As of 2015, only 70% of Oregon's two-year-olds have received all their vaccines recommended by ACIP's routine schedule, one of the lowest rates in the country. We are concerned that any additional paperwork required of healthcare providers may further erode our immunization rates. The decision of whether to include an ACIP-recommended vaccine in the requirements for schools and child facilities in Oregon are made by the Oregon Health Authority's immunization program after consultation with OHA's School, Child Facilities, and College Immunization Law Advisory Committee, who recommends a decision based on reviewing 12 criteria. These criteria include disease factors, vaccine availability, administration burden, and economic factors, among others. As an example, annual influenza vaccine is recommended for everyone over 6 years of age by ACIP. Influenza vaccine is unlikely, though, to be added as a school or child facility requirement, even though widespread influenza vaccination could decrease annual deaths in infants and the elderly. The reason these are not required for school attendance is that the administration burden of tracking receipt of vaccine every year is just too large for our schools. Additionally, vaccine supply fluctuations mean that we could not be certain that we'd have enough vaccine available on a year-to-year basis. Parents already have access to which vaccines are required for school or child care attendance in Oregon. For example, a simple online search of Oregon required immunizations. Your first three hits will be from the Public Health Division. The first link is for required shots for school and child's facilities. The second link is for non-medical vaccine exemptions.
We would be pleased to share these criteria with you if you'd like. Adding a vaccine as a requirement should not be considered as prioritizing the required vaccine over recommended vaccines. For optimal protection from disease, each child should be vaccinated for all vaccines recommended by ACIP on the published schedule. I would just add that this bill would require an authorized signer of the Oregon Certificate of Immunization Status, or the CIS form, to document that each vaccine received, the parent or guardian received notice of which vaccines are required for school or children's attendance. We could add this language to the signature line of the CIS form. However, a large percentage of our CIS forms are printed from Alert Immunization Information System, or IIS, based on data received from medical providers. Alert IIS does not have a method for tracking the consent process in a medical office or verifying that the written process was signed. Additionally, if this requirement applied for all CIS forms already on file, we estimate that schools and children facilities would have to re-sign 650,000 students' CIS forms. Thank you for this opportunity to share this information. We'd be happy to take questions.
Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Aaron, can you restate your title, your position?
So I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the State of Oregon.
Okay, follow up. Aaron, are all vaccines safe for all children?
Now there's, Chair, members of the committee, there's the process of you can apply for and receive medical exemption for vaccines.
Sure. Follow up. So are there children who are injured by vaccines?
Chair and members of the committee, that would be the evidence we have from the system that's in place and the words given.
So, follow up. So there is evidence that some children are injured by vaccines.
I'm not an expert on that, but I would assume that's the case.
Well, that's certainly the case in terms of what the government has done to settle cases as it relates to vaccine injuries. So I think we all know that that's true. So I think there's been people who have stated that vaccines are safe and effective, but it seems like that's really only a half-truth, that vaccines are safe and effective for some children, or maybe even most children, but not all children. And so I think that's why people are looking for the opportunity to have more information in these bills. Follow-up question, though. So Jim, are you a doctor?
No, I'm not.
Do you know much about herd immunity?
Somewhat, yeah.
A little bit. So I'm 51, and I had probably five childhood vaccines. And my understanding is that probably those have worn off by now. And so my question is people of my generation and maybe earlier who haven't been vaccinated in decades, are we a problem as it relates to herd immunity, or is this just an issue for school-age kids and kids in daycare?
Chair members of the committee, I could definitely provide additional information on that. There are diseases that tend to spread in certain age groups or certain populations. And so, for example, the meningococcal B that's spreading at our universities recently, it's well established that those are spread on-campus scenarios. And so we're trying to interrupt the spread of disease on that campus by encouraging vaccinations. So it depends on the disease and the population.
Okay. Follow up. So, Aaron, I think maybe you or maybe it was Ryan mentioned outbreaks. There's been some outbreaks. And in the stories that I've read that, you know, you never know what you're reading these days and where you're reading it and if it's true or not, right? But I think with some of these measles outbreaks, there have been at least reported stories that many of, not all, maybe some, maybe many, of the children who had gotten the measles had actually been vaccinated. So do you know if that's true? And if so, do you know why?
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, I can't verify that per se. We could do some follow-up on that for you. There's definitely a possibility that not all vaccines are 100% effective. By each individual vaccine, they'll have a certain percentage of effectiveness. And even of those that are vaccinated that may get a disease, it's often noted that those receive much lower rates of side effects and impact of the disease.
To follow up, do any of those vaccines shed so that somebody who came in contact with somebody who's been vaccinated, could they catch the disease if they're not vaccinated?
Chair Miles Anderson, members of the committee, I would defer to my medical colleagues on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I was a polio pioneer. I mean, that tells you how old I am. But in second grade, we were exposed to, or we were, the first polio vaccines came forward. They were oral and, I believe, and I had several in my first grade class that had had polio, and there was huge fear of polio, and this was before vaccine, and I just needed to put that on the record that I had friends of mine who had polio, and we just about eradicated polio now, but you know, I do hear what some of you are saying on reactions to some, but that some children have a reaction to some vaccines. But the fear that was rampant back when I was young was definitely rampant because polio was such a devastating disease. That's all I wanted to say for the record. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's have Stacy Kayla and Michael King. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Mons Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Stacy Case. I am a resident of Hillsborough in Senate District 12. I'm also the Executive Director of Oregonians for Medical Freedom. I am here in favor of all three bills. So regarding Senate Bill 580, parents and caregivers, along with their medical provider, should be the ones that decide that vaccines are in the best interest of the child. While the child or caregiver or the parent or caregiver is already at the doctor's office, this is the best time to discuss what vaccinations are required for school and what the exemptions are for Oregon. Parents and caregivers turn to their medical providers to trust, and through this relationship, this is the best way to make those decisions. I have a document as part of my testimony. This document is provided by OHA in their school packets, and they're sent out to school districts every year. It's the one that you guys have seen already. But as you can see, there's no mention of anything about an exemption, medical or non-medical, listed on this flyer. These flyers are found in doctor's offices, schools, and health offices around the state. I cannot tell you how many times in a month I receive the same question from parents and caregivers. Has the law changed in Oregon? What has happened to the exemptions? I just saw this flyer in my doctor's office. Our own website even links to the educational module provided by the state. Providing this information online has obviously not been clear enough, even for parents and caregivers I speak with, and needs to be provided at the time of the well-child visits or office visits. Parents and caregivers are not aware of this information, even though you or I may think it may be easy to find or just Google. Besides, who's best to have this conversation other than their trusted medical care provider? I urge the committee to support Senate Bill 580, and this will help provide clarification to parents and caregivers in the best way possible under the advice of their trusted medical provider. And regarding Senate Bill 869, I apologize, this is a little long. I'll try to get through it as fast as possible. This bill will provide for a true informed consent for a medical procedure using a pharmaceutical product. If you think about informed consent in terms of other medical procedures or pharmaceutical products, this bill brings vaccination in alignment with those. I have two examples I wanted to share with you where in my day-to-day life I've had examples of informed consent recently. I have a box of prescription medication. It's been prescribed to a family member. Don't worry, I've taken off the name, so no HIPAA violations here. But this is given out at the pharmacy. Inside of it is this really long form, and I could pull it out and it'll go for miles. They are provided when someone orders a prescription. Are there scary side effects listed? Of course. The manufacturers of the product are giving you all the data they have, good and bad. Could this change your mind if you wanted to take this medication? Possibly. But my guess is you've already had a discussion with your doctor, and you've also been offered by a consult by the pharmacist when you pick up your medication. And at this point, you understand the use of this medication, despite the side effects listed in this package here, is necessary for your health, and the good outweighs the bad. You've been able to make an informed choice. My daughter recently needed a series of dental procedures. In her treatment plan, I was offered three different paths. I sat with a patient care expert in her dental office, and we went over each procedure line by line, from the most invasive to the least invasive, and the pros and cons of each. I was given full information regarding the pharmaceutical products to be used in the procedures, and also the office information to contact other doctors that could be potentially involved in the other procedures so that I could speak with them and schedule a consult to be informed in the role. I needed to sign off on each and understand what was involved. Did each procedure pose a risk? Yes, of course. But through this process, I was able to make an informed choice of what path I wanted to pursue. She still got her needed treatment, but I was informed and consented. I've outlined two examples that show how informed consent applies to other aspects of our lives. But what about vaccines? When a vaccine is given, the medical provider is supposed to provide a document called the Vaccine Information Sheet, or VIS. In a non-scientific poll of my friends, I asked if they have been provided the sheet recently. 50% told me no. This is in the state of Oregon. Considering this is a law, that is concerning to only see 50% compliance. Is that providing true informed consent for a medical procedure? This bill would bring the vaccination in alignment with my two examples. If your pharmacist gives you the insert in your prescription, provides a consult, and you have to accept or decline, that is informed consent. If a dentist's office has to provide all options of a treatment plan, the risks and potential side effects of the pharmaceuticals they're using, and you sign off in each on one, that's informed consent. In 2001, I was given an MMR vaccine. I was applying to volunteer as a doula at OHSU for a pilot program. I also received the MMR as a child, again in 1991, 1995, and 1996. Why so many? I test non-immune to rubella. Two of those dates, I was pregnant and tested non-immune and was given the vaccine immediately after the birth of my child. However, those were all on a military base. And when 2001 came around, I didn't have quick access to those records to show OHSU that I had had a vaccine within the last 10 years. The only thing I was told is that I needed that vaccine to be part of this pilot program, which I really wanted to do. And that I was, when the vaccine was given, I was verbally told and asked, was I currently pregnant, which I wasn't, and told them no. About 3 months later, I conceived my son. He was born healthy. When he was just a day old, I was sitting on my living room floor in the wee hours of the morning trying to nurse him. He was wailing, arching his back, and not acting at all like my first two children in that first few days of life, and I knew something was wrong with him. I took him to an urgent care pediatrician, explained he wasn't eating well, he was crying, and I was concerned. I was ignored. He also became very jaundiced, and we never got him to nurse properly. I sought answers for many different doctors for months and years, and we got nothing. Then it was clear he wasn't meeting his basic milestones. He didn't roll over, sit up, crawl, walk, babble on time. Again, no answers from any doctor. We finally pushed, referred to a geneticist to see if there was something genetic. Nothing found. When he turned two, his pediatrician gave me a diagnosis, PDD-NOS, persuasive development disorder not otherwise specified. Later, he was diagnosed with autism. In 2001, the ACIP changed their recommendation on when an MMR is given to women of childbearing age, from a recommendation that a woman should not get pregnant within 3 months of the vaccination to 28 days. This was based on a study of 680 women. That is all, just 680. They determined there was a theoretical risk of a small percent, but felt that it was enough to make a change in recommendation. And I have that information here in my testimony. The reason the MMR is not given during this time, and also in the few months after a woman is pregnant, is because the MMR vaccine is a live virus, and there's a risk that the fetus can contract congenital rubella syndrome, or CRS. This generally occurs when a woman who is pregnant is exposed to someone who has rubella, but since this is a live vaccine, it can also be contracted that way. However, in the insert for the MMR vaccine, the very insert that we would like to be shared, and it says, and I quote, "Women of childbearing age should be advised not to become pregnant for 3 months after vaccination and should be informed of the reasons for this precaution." I was not informed of this. I was not provided an insert. I did not know about this precaution until my son was 3 years old, because only I dug into the matter and not because any medical provider told me. The CDC provides what they call a case definition for classification on congenital rubella syndrome. For a classification called suspected, this is for an infant who does not meet the criteria for a probable or confirmed diagnosis, they have to have one or more of the list of findings, and I've included this list in my testimony. On this list includes both jaundice and developmental delays, both of which my son had. I feel that my son was injured due to an MMR vaccine given to me within 3 months of conception. The vaccine insert for the MMR clearly states this precaution, but it was never given to me, and it is the current recommendation that women wait 28 days. It is imperative that all parents are given information when vaccines are given. With every medical procedure, there is a risk. I respectfully request that you support Senate Bill 869.
Thank you very much, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you. And I can run through Senate Bill 914 in about 10 seconds?
Yes, please, because we're running.
Okay.
Some people have not used up all their time, sure. So this is great.
Okay, and this one's pretty short. I'm also in favor of Senate Bill 914. There's no reason for an employer to mandate a vaccination as a requirement for employment. It's a private medical decision made between the employee and their doctor. There may be reasons that they choose not to vaccinate. Could be religious, could be something else. And it's a privacy concern if they have to discuss this with their employers to why. As I discussed in my previous testimony about the MMR vaccine, and I was required to get that upon condition of working at OHSU. I was not provided all the information, and I now have a vaccine-injured child. Perhaps this could be a case for a woman who's looking to start a family or have another child. Maybe she's informed on what the insert says and doesn't want to follow the ACIP recommendation of 28 days, so she wants to wait a full 3 months before she conceives after having the MMR. If it's a case like this, it wouldn't be in the business of the employer to know this, but if she's required to have the MMR vaccine for employment, she could be fired or have to share personal information that she doesn't want to with her employer. So I also respectfully request that you support Senate Bill 914.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Manos Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for hearing these bills today. My name is Michael King. I'm a bachelor's prepared registered nurse. I work in Portland, Oregon at a local hospital. I wanted to talk about each of the bills separately, but before I begin with Bill 580, I just wanted to make a side note. Earlier, a number of statements were made about polio, and I don't want to negate in any way that polio is a horrible disease for those it affects significantly, but there's not actually sufficient scientific data to say that we've eradicated polio in the U.S., and the reason I say that is the most common symptoms of polio include symptoms of the common cold. So fever, chills, I mean things, and fever between flu and the cold, I'm sorry. So because we don't test the common cold to see if it's actually polio, there is zero data to say, because we don't test it, to see that polio has been eradicated or not. So while I appreciate my previous colleague saying that we've eradicated, we actually have no data to prove that that is the case. So I just think it's important when we look at scientific fact that we take in all of the facts in that process. So back to Senate Bill 580. First, I'm kind of appalled that other healthcare professionals reject efforts to provide people with information on medical procedures. That's a bit absurd to me as a nurse, because that's what we do. With that said, though, I support Senate Bill 580, and I would like to see it move forward out of the committee. Moving to Senate Bill 869, first, I support this bill. I want to highlight Section 2B, which I believe is an important line in the bill, and explain why. Section 2B says if the child is receiving a vaccination, that we'd provide a copy of both the vaccine information statement from the CDC, which is this right here, and a copy of the vaccine package insert for that vaccine. I think both are important. And while somebody previously mentioned that the CDC insert is sufficient, I can prove that that is not true. First of all, the flu vaccine itself, and again, I just took this from my workplace last night, so it's the current one we're using for this year. It says the symptoms vary from the side effects of the flu. What they don't mention is three main ones: nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. The reason that's important, clinically speaking, I'll tell you a little story from a patient I had recently. This individual was getting their jaw wired shut that next day. They had just come in, and we routinely ask every individual whether they want the flu shot and the pneumonia vaccine. This is standard procedure in the hospital. It's made free of charge, available to every person who wants it, and we ask everybody. There are clinical risks associated with having your jaw wired shut and having vomiting. However, and I mean, we have emergency procedures in place, such as having scissors at the bedside so we can cut open the wiring and or banding on their jaw in case of an emergency. But though that information, those risks, we don't provide to the patient, and they're not listed on this flu insert. They are, however, listed in the vaccine insert that's provided by the manufacturers. Additionally, also not on this insert, is that pregnant and nursing mothers, the flu vaccine has never been tested for safety or efficacy in pregnant and nursing mothers. The reason is because it's unethical. You legally cannot test it in a pregnant mother. You can't do it. So we will never have that information. We can never prove that it's safe or effective in a pregnant mother, because it's essentially performing live testing on a fetus. Can't do it. So I think it's important to be able to understand that while we can say yes, informed consent, quote unquote, is provided by the CDC vaccine information statement, one, that's not true. And two, I think it's beneficial to have the CDC information statement for somebody who wants a quick read through. It does have the vaccine injury compensation program information. There's a bunch of good data on here, but it does not present the whole picture. So I believe that that part of 869 is a very important part of this bill, and I would just encourage us to go ahead and move that forward out of committee, especially keeping that line intact. And one other point on that is, as a nurse, I'm told we're supposed to just tell people vaccines are safe and effective. Now, I understand the scope of this bill is not to provide education to healthcare professionals, but the problem is that many healthcare professionals don't know the information that I'm sharing with you, just for example, about this jaw surgery patient. But they provide clinical risks to that patient's outcomes and well-being, including aspiration, which is getting vomit or other substances down into your lungs, which then puts you at risk for pneumonia and death. So there are real clinical concerns. Even if this person were to get the flu vaccine 4 weeks later after their banding was undone, fine. But without sufficient consent provided by sufficient information, those are the types of things that we can't prevent. And I understand this bill is directed toward children. The one thing I would recommend that we change, add, or update is to make this, or possibly even another bill in the future, to expand this to all of the population and not just the child, to avoid problems like I'm expressing here. Moving on to Senate Bill 914, this is the one that has to do with immunizations being a personal health care decision and really no business of the employer. First of all, I support this bill, and I want to explain why. People get or don't get vaccines for a variety of reasons in either direction. Federal law currently prohibits discrimination based on medical status, such as disabilities, for religion. There are a number of things we prohibit federally for discrimination. This is a personal health decision for the individual, and it's between the individual and their doctor. Once you start to take personal health information and introduce that as a condition for employment, we know that already through disabilities and other problems, that's called discrimination. So there's a part of me that doesn't understand how we can do anything other than pass this bill, because if we don't pass the bill, we're basically saying, yes, we'd like to discriminate against people. And I know that's not the goal of the Senate committee, and it's certainly not anything anybody in Oregon wants. The MTHFR gene is a gene that 30 to 50% of the population, it's actually a gene series, and they have either one or a series of these genes, and they're either basically, to simplify the science, they're either positive and have it, negative and don't have it, or have a combination thereof. It's a well-documented scientific fact that those who have either part of the negative aspect of that gene or all of it are at higher risk for problems from vaccines. Not necessarily from the disease portion that has the proteins of the diseases, but from a lot of the other additives. Personally, I am at risk. I get violently ill every time I get the flu shot. I mean, within hours. I mean, it's very much like you take a medication, you expect it to do something. I get a flu shot, I get violently ill within hours. It is a side effect listed on the insert, again, of the vaccine. I'm just one of the people who has that problem. What we're saying is that because I am medically unable to get this vaccine, if we don't pass this bill, we are willing to discriminate against me because of my medical status. And that, to me, I just don't even understand why we would consider that. So I have to assume that we're going to pass this bill. Additionally, the whole reason that exemptions exist, whether it's religious, philosophical, medical, it doesn't matter. The fact is these exemptions exist because there are freedoms that we are given in this nation. So if we want to say that vaccines may be considered as a form of condition for employment, what we're saying is that exemptions are irrelevant, which means religious protections, medical protections are also irrelevant. So we can't really have both simultaneously. Somebody, Brittany Reese, the sponsor of one of the bills previously, noted that she was forced to get a flu shot for clinicals. I was, and as I said, I was injured because I can't get these flu shots. When I get sick, I call in sick, so I'm not really a risk to my patients either. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of arguments about, oh, we need to protect our population, and that's true, but we need to look at the bigger picture and that there are other factors and protections put in place to make that happen. We weigh in favor of the individual with regards to gender, disability, sexuality. I don't see weighing in favor of the individual in regards to their personal health and medical status as provided already by the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act. I don't see this as any different. It's really in some ways a continuation of that to prevent discrimination. That, I believe, is basically all I wanted to say. If businesses are not willing to accept non-discrimination laws, then that's a federal issue. And I don't see this bill as anything other than simply continue what we already see on a federal level. Thank you very much, and I'm open to any questions.
I appreciate you coming, both of you. Thank you so much. Questions? Okay. All right. Who do we have left here? Okay, Melissa, is it Metal and Sarah Gobet and Ann Durant?
Madam Chair and members of the Health Committee, my name is Sarah Soltani Gobay, and I am constituent of District 17. I am here today to testify in favor of SB 869, 580, actually all three. I strongly believe parents need to have better informed consent. I'm the mother of three. My oldest, who is now a junior in high school, was vaccine injured at the age of five immediately following kindergarten boosters. I wasn't informed of VAERS or the injury compensation program until long after the statute of limitations expired. We as parents are left to pick up the pieces in addition to the financial burden of treatments after a vaccine injury. True parental informed consent is a must. This last February, three of my daughter's high school teachers and her counselor encouraged her to get a DTaP up to date prior to the exclusion day coming up. They reminded her multiple times over the next few weeks. I assured her I had it taken care of, until I rewatched the education module and turned in her exemption form 2 days prior to exclusion day. I'm not exactly sure why a biology, European studies, and stagecraft teacher felt it was their duty to encourage my child to get vaccinated, but it is the very reason that we need SB 869 in place. Any other minor may have felt the pressure to comply and would have consented. Is this what we want for our kids? Adults bullying them into making medical decisions for themselves, not based on family history, adverse reactions, or parental consent. Just do it or you're going to get kicked out of school. No mention of exemptions, no mention of having their parents talk to their doctors. I had a similar bullying experience with an ER doctor at St. Vincent's recently when I took her to get stitches after falling off her bike. She was 14 at the time, and although I politely declined DTaP for the tetanus portion, explaining previous adverse reactions, he insisted it was needed despite the fact that her wound was open, exposed to oxygen, bleeding, and easily cleaned. There was no chance for anaerobic tetanus to survive in that environment. I proceeded to ask him why he was scaring her, telling her that she would die without a tetanus shot. It takes several weeks for antibodies to mount an immune response to the vaccine. And on the CDC's own website, it states that when they did a surveillance in a seven-year period between 2001 to 2008, there were 233 cases of tetanus and 26 deaths. In the United States, with a population of over 300 million, that's an average of less than 33 tetanus cases annually and an average of less than 4 deaths a year. My child was at no risk dying that day from tetanus, and the ER doctor should have been offering the TIG, the tetanus immunoglobulin. Instead, but had she been left to make her own medical decisions, may have felt forced into accepting the wrong medical procedure, which is what vaccines are. They are a medical procedure, and they are legally termed unavoidably unsafe. As her mother, I have her best interests at heart, not a doctor or nurse blindly following a one-size-fits-all protocol. The informed consent policy as it stands is not enough to protect our children. Our kids need our parental consent. I hope you will consider passing 869, actually all three bills, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Weddle, and I'm a pediatrician at Oregon Health and Science University. And thank you for taking the time to hear from me today. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University and the Oregon Medical Association to share our concerns in opposition to Senate Bill 580 and Senate Bill 869. I've been a pediatrician for 29 years and the past 8 years here in Oregon. Every day, I work to keep our children healthy. Senate Bill 580 and Senate Bill 869 present barriers to keeping children safe from preventable diseases. In order for a child to attend primary school or a daycare facility in Oregon, immunization records or documentation of a child's exemption are required. In 2015, according to the Oregon Public Health Department, about 2,700 kindergartners, almost 6% of all kindergartners, claimed an exemption to one or more required vaccines. This is a 17% decline from 2014, and this put Oregon's rate of immunization close to achieving community immunity. And this means that when enough children are immunized, not only are there lower rates of measles, pertussis, and other vaccine-preventable diseases, but children who cannot be vaccinated due to their age or medical condition are protected. The decline of Oregon's exemption rate is attributed in part to legislation passed in 2013 that requires that parents who wish to exempt their child from vaccination for a non-medical reason must either discuss the benefits and risk of immunization with their health care provider or watch an educational video on the Oregon Health Authority website. Senate Bill 580 and Senate Bill 869, if passed, would undo the gains of this 2013 legislation by placing duplicative and burdensome requirements on both healthcare providers and patients. It is important to understand that as healthcare providers, we already are required to discuss the risk and benefits of each vaccination that we recommend, or any procedure for that matter. As part of that discussion, we give parents the vaccine information sheet published by the Centers for Disease Control. In addition, to complete information about the vaccine, including benefits and possible side effects, the VIS also contains the contact information for the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. For those of you who have not seen the VIS forms, I have copies here that you're welcome to have. And you can see that over half the form is about side effects and other serious effects, as well as information about the compensation program. The requirement of Senate Bill 869 to include an additional state-formatted written notice and a journal excerpt that was not written for the layperson has the risk of overwhelming the parent, resulting in delay or refusal of immunization. This disrupts my relationship with my patients. Senate Bill 132 in 2012 has effectively led to appropriate vaccination education, including risk and benefits of the vaccine, and the legislature has consistently maintained appropriate vaccination exemptions. We urge your support for maintaining and improving the health of all Oregon's children, as well as our citizens who are most vulnerable, those with compromised immune systems, infants too young to receive vaccinations, and the elderly. This morning in my clinic, before coming here, I cared for a little girl who could not receive some immunizations because of a problem with her immune system, and I want her to be safe walking out of my clinic. You may know that in Oregon we experienced an outbreak of measles in 2012 and pertussis in 2014. Every year in my hospital, we care for very sick children who have diseases that could have been prevented. So that we can continue to do our best to keep our children healthy, we encourage you to vote no on Senate Bill 580 and Senate Bill 869. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Let's go with one more, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Okay. I'm Ann Durant. I'm a chiropractor, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to hear testimony on these bills, Senator Anderson. Committee. I am testifying in favor of these bills. Senator Knapp had a question about measles coverage, I pulled out from testimony a long time ago references to measles outbreaks and completely to very highly vaccinated populations, measles vaccinated populations. Mumps outbreaks now are bringing up the controversy over mumps vaccine failure. There's a lawsuit about that. Old testimony, and it's not even my current testimony, but when I hear about pertussis, I think it's been six and more years since it's been recognized that the pertussis vaccine, the effectiveness of it wanes within 6 months of the last dose that a child receives at five, and that the pertussis organism has mutated so that it doesn't have the protectin that the vaccine is made to, the antigen that the vaccine is made to attack via antibodies. It's mutated. That strain is not a predominant strain. So there are more outbreaks of pertussis, and the policy is to keep pushing the vaccine that is not effective. I'd like to overall talk about informed consent, and that it is acknowledged by the federal government that vaccines are unavoidably unsafe. That's a little different than seat belts and helmets. That severe and permanent vaccine injuries and deaths have been recorded since the practice of mass vaccination began with smallpox. And there's a profound and growing body of science in peer-reviewed scientific and medical journals regarding the complexity of artificially altering immunity, the myriad adverse reactions to vaccines that result in disease and disabilities in susceptible populations that cannot always be identified until they're injured. Susceptible individuals may be due to genetic conditions, concurrent illnesses, or other environmental exposures. But vaccine policies and medical training are based on the dogmas that vaccines are safe and effective and the science is settled. And any information to the contrary is dangerous to the greater good. So many medical doctors and nurses have stated that in medical school they're trained that vaccines are safe and effective and to ignore adverse reactions listed in the manufacturer's inserts. So I was struggling with the informed part of the idea of informed consent. It is impossible to be completely informed of how your body is going to react to any pharmaceutical product. But when it comes to even listing some of the more common side effects, it's a difficult concept to talk about informed consent when the practitioners aren't informed themselves. Reviewing the vaccine package insert and sharing it with patients would be a start. It could help the practitioner's ability to identify and report adverse events. As you hear about children whose skin breaks out, who have seizures, who have a high-pitched scream, and they're told this is normal, they're dismissed. If a practitioner is better able to identify and report adverse events, it could ultimately help identify some risk patterns and contribute to vaccine safety. I would like to, with respect to Senate Bill 869, which requires the health practitioner to get informed consent from a parent for a minor, I'd like to address Gardasil in particular, because that vaccine has been pushed as one where you would do it in schools or clinics without parental consent. There are articles published in the Journal of Law and Medical Ethics and the American Journal of Public Health that point out how the Gardasil manufacturer, Merck, fast-tracked it, aggressively influenced public health policies regarding Gardasil by using their own science and data, and aggressively and non-transparently lobbied legislators to mandate their vaccine. They drafted the legislation and made financial contributions to lawmakers. Teenagers are being told in the media and by authority figures in school that this vaccine will make them one less, and it will protect them from cancer. Children, their parents, and even the well-meaning practitioners administering the vaccine are probably not informed that cervical cancer is responsible for less than 1% of cancer deaths, and those primarily occur in unscreened populations. And there is currently no evidence that Gardasil prevents cancer. Most do not know that there are more serious event reports for Gardasil than any other vaccines, and they include permanent disability, prolonged hospitalization, ER visits, and death. It's been linked to, I have references here for you, including Immunological American Journal of Reproductive Health, human papillomavirus vaccine and primary ovarian failure, another facet of the autoimmune inflammatory syndrome induced by adjuvants from Journal of Internal Medicine, peripheral sympathetic nerve dysfunction in adolescent Japanese girls following immunization with a human papillomavirus, from the International Journal of Vaccines, is chronic fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalomyelitis, a relevant diagnosis in patients with suspected side effects to human papillomavirus. Another medical journal, suspected side effects to the quadrivalent human papilloma vaccine from clinical rheumatology, hypothesis, human papilloma vaccine syndrome, small fiber neuropathy and dysautotomia could be its underlying pathogenesis. Clinical rheumatology, discusses it with systemic lupus erythematosus. So I'd say it's not ethical to administer this vaccine to a minor who has been confronted with social pressure and informed by pretty commercials without parental consent. Besides the right of a parent to make health care decisions in the best interest of their child, it's important for the parent to be able to knowingly observe and take appropriate action for their child should the child receive the vaccine and manifest any adverse events. There's also research that shows that the HPV vaccine has negative efficacy and may exacerbate cervical disease in females who are exposed to HPV strains prior to being vaccinated. It's also questionable whether young girls that receive the vaccine will maintain their immunity by the time they're sexually active. I'd like to address the influenza vaccine in particular as a condition of employment. And also, I think this applies to Senate Bill 580 because flu vaccine is one of the vaccines currently recommended and given to infants and children that is not required as a condition to attend school. From Vaccine Journal, there is no evidence that vaccinating healthcare workers protects patients and elderly. Internal Journal of Family Medicine. What, in fact, is the evidence that vaccinating healthcare workers against seasonal influenza for their patients? They find that the evidence is not there. The Archives of Internal Medicine reports that no improvement of influenza-related death rates. There are no influenza-related death rates in elderly from of death rates in the elderly from influenza vaccinations. Clinical and Journal of Infectious Disease show that children are more at risk after influenza vaccination. They have increased risk of non-influenza respiratory virus. Allergy Asthma Journal, the...
Can you wind
there's
up?
A three,
we have...
Three, pardon me?
You need to wind up. We have still
okay.
Another...
Threefold increased risk of hospitalization in children who get a trivalent inactivated influenza vaccine. I didn't include the research about flu mist because that's no longer used. It was found to be ineffective. Influenza of pregnant women is not supported by science. And also more buzz about this recently that the receipt of annual flu shots causes higher susceptibility to subsequent influenza or viral strains and also causes worse response and higher susceptibility the year following an influenza vaccine.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All of you for your testimony. Brian Gooden. And I believe that is the last one, and we have, unfortunately, 3 or 4 minutes left before we need to get out of here. Thank you, everyone, for being so timely with your testimony.
Chair Monas Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. My name is Brian Gooden. I manage employee health for the Legacy Health Hospital Network, and I hold a master's degree in public health with specialty in my 12-year career in infectious disease and occupational safety. I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 914 on behalf of Oregon's 62 hospitals, health systems, the patients they serve, and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I also think it's important to point out that there are already restrictions prohibiting mandatory vaccination by healthcare employers under ORS 433.416. So we are already incorporating that practice into all of the legacy hospitals, as well as, I assume, the other hospitals in our association. Hospitals and healthcare workers have a responsibility to avoid causing harm. As a licensed nurse, I take this very seriously myself, as do many of my colleagues, especially in public health. Immunizations are rooted in scientific evidence, promote patient safety, and extend protection to vulnerable populations such as children, older adults, persons with weakened immune systems, and in fact, the very type of people that come to us for services in healthcare. Healthcare worker immunizations include measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, pertussis, meningitis, influenza, and hepatitis B. These contagious infections are known to cause death, birth defects, or other avoidable outcomes in the high acuity patients that we serve daily. They also put staff at risk of spreading infections to their families and create a financial burden on employers if employees were to become ill. The diseases prevented by immunizations are still very real in our state. This winter, Oregon endured a tough influenza season, setting a new record for the state number of hospitalizations caused by that virus. Many hospitals across the state were at capacity, were diverting from clients, also experiencing severe staffing shortages due to sick call. Beyond influenza, the Pacific Northwest states are currently experiencing more than twice the national rate of whooping cough. This infection is caused by bacteria which can be transmitted by adults without symptoms into infants at very high risk of severe outcomes. Senate Bill 914 would prevent hospitals from collecting important data and from meeting national and international standards. Immunity status information is used to protect our patients, employees, and communities. This bill would prohibit tracking of immunity status for virulent pathogens and delay our urgent, my department's urgent response in a hospital setting during times of acute disease exposure. Delaying our response also means risking spread of infection, not only to our employees, but to their families and to their communities and to the patients that we work very hard to serve. Additionally, requirements are in place already that hold hospitals to annual vaccination rate reports for their employees and all healthcare worker personnel. We report this to Center for Medicare Services as part of our national patient safety metrics, and they're taken into an account as part of our reimbursement guidelines. So directly have a cost associated with not being able to gather this information. Senate Bill 914 would restrict our hospitals from meeting this annual requirement. Oregon cannot afford another tough influenza season, another whooping cough death, another meningitis outbreak. SB 914 puts our Oregon hospitals and community at risk, and I stand in opposition. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions? I can't believe that we made it on time. Thank you.
Chair?
Oh, yes.
I didn't get to testify on all my bills. Do I get it like a half hour? Or? It's not. I am in support of all my bills.
Gotcha. You're on record.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 914. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 580, and I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 869, and we are adjourned. 869, and we are adjourned.